If you're struggling in your career, business, or life, this podcast is for you. 9/11 survivor Ari Schoenbrunn shares inspiring interviews so you too can rise like a phoenix from the ashes to live your best life. Here's your host, Ari.
Welcome to Whispers and Bricks. My name is Ari Schoenbrunn. I'm your host. Today, I have as my guest, Lindsay Jewell. Now, normally when I do the show, when I open the show, I normally read a bio of my guest, give you a little bit of flavor of what the guest is all about, and then I welcome them to the show. In this particular case, Lindsay has been through so much that there was just no way to put it into a short bio. It was impossible. So I said, you know what? I'm going to skip the bio and we're going to go straight to welcoming Lindsay into the show. And in her own words, I'm going to let her basically tell you her story. And this is going to be, fasten your seatbelts. This is going to be a wild ride. So without further ado, please help me welcome Lindsay Jewell.
Hi.
Lindsay, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I am wonderful. And now that you're here, I'm even better.
Great.
Okay. So as you just heard, all right, I'm going to let you do the talking because this is all about you. And I think if it were me, people wouldn't believe me. all right. So, let's start. The bricks started coming to you when you were all but 6 years old, correct?
Correct.
All right. Tell us about, let's go through from age six to age 13. How's that?
Okay. Yes, that is fine. So at age six, unfortunately, had a event. I was a victim of child molestation. So were some other boys and my brother. The guy was a neighbor of ours. And so when my parents went around, we played and this guy was also part of that Boy Scout. I don't know if everybody's heard about that Boy Scout stuff that was going on where there was a bunch of molestations going on. So this is back in the 80s. And, there are a lot of people have been sexually abused as children. A lot of them went unreported. Ours did not. Eventually what happened was one of the other little boys started showing signs or something and his father knew something was wrong. And eventually he told what was going on. So, hence what started the investigation. So, I was in kindergarten at the time and, during this time, of course, I didn't say what was going on. This man had threatened to kill my parents if I told anybody what he did, let alone know the fact of what he was doing at age six. I mean, it's just absolutely horrendous. So in kindergarten, all of a sudden, I get pulled out of class. And there are two, which obviously now I know are detectives. Back then, I just thought police officers. And you want to talk about scared and guilt or just all these feelings you're not supposed to feel at six go on inside of you. And these two detectives were asking very, very explicit questions about this man and if he had done this, talk about private parts and stuff. Till this day, I'm very, it's very hard for me to say sexual words like that, I guess, probably from that trauma.
Let me ask you something. When you were taken out and you were with the detectives, were your parents there?
No, I was in school.
It was in school. Mm-hmm. And I mean, was there a teacher there? Was there anybody other than the detectives in that room?
No.
That's a little, that's odd.
This is the late 80s.
Okay.
All
right. Go ahead.
But I mean, that was terrifying because in my mind, this man was, an adult, a friend, a trusted person. And when you see police officers, something's not right, I guess. And so after school was over that day, my brother, I told him he told me that same thing, like some detectives, we're asking him questions about this man. But we never told each other what was going on because I don't know how to explain it. Imagine being that age. You don't know what those body parts are for. You weren't told that nobody should do this and you shouldn't know any of that stuff. So it's really embarrassing and uncomfortable. And we just kind of, just kind of said, yeah, detectives came and talked to us about, I don't know if I should say his name, but, you know, we were just on edge, I guess. My parents didn't know anything was going on. I remember like having nightmares, but I still, like I said, wasn't going to tell my parents what was going on because the man threatened to kill my parents if I did. So then, you know, an investigation gets started, and that, if that wasn't enough, and this is part of children that are, you know, sexually abused. The other little boy sexually abused me. My own brother did. It's not that it was nobody's fault. It's a sick thing that happens to children. They call it grooming. They don't, you know. And of course, my mind at that age doesn't associate any of this, of anything wrong. It knows something's wrong, but like, it doesn't, it's not supposed to process that kind of stuff, right?
Right.
So then, go ahead.
Yeah, no. So basically, you know, a lot has been happening, whatever, but they actually caught the guy. And they ultimately had a trial and they ultimately convicted to him.
Yes, we actually, as the trial was going on, we moved down the street, not far from where it happened. But this man came to our school, to me, my brother's elementary school, saying he was our uncle there to pick us up. And I remember my mother running into our elementary school, like just, I mean, totally terrified. And I think till this day that man was going to kidnap us and obviously maybe do something bad and kill us. I don't want confirmation, but why else would he come try to pretend to be somebody to pick us up? There's an investigation going on, you know?
Right. Now, that wasn't the person who molested you, or
yeah,
it was.
That was.
That was the guy.
Yeah, uh-huh. The investigation was going on.
Right.
So
okay.
I can't tell you how many years the investigation went on in my mind. Like, it wasn't something I kept track of.
Right.
I remember like my grandparents seeing the man on TV when they finally, you know, got a warrant out for him, and he was on TV in shackles. And as a child, seeing that, this is where I guess so much guilt just stored in me, felt like I did something bad or we did something bad because he was an adult friend to us,
right.
And now he's in trouble. So we did go to the trial. That was crazy. A bailiff went up to my father and said, whatever you do, don't kill this man. It's not worth it, you know? And I was just like, why would he say that to my father? You know? It's hard to wrap around being such a young child, knowing that something bad happened and somebody's in trouble for it. And, you know, we're part of it in a way, I guess.
Right. So he was convicted, I think, to what, 22 years in jail?
In 1989.
Right. Uh-huh. And then I guess ultimately around the age of 9 or so, you moved to California.
Yeah, after the trial was over and stuff, my parents moved us to California. Yeah.
Okay.
And my brother started showing signs of germophobia, started washing his hands a lot. And this is where the family dynamics really changed. We never talked about what happened, but we all knew what happened, I guess.
How many siblings were you? Is it just you and your brother? It's just you and your brother. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, my brother's just a couple of years older than me. So, my mother was a night shift nurse back then, and my father engineer. So, I think I saw all of this stirred up emotion everywhere, and they were focusing on my brother because he was starting to act out and do things. And I, for some reason, told myself to just shut down. And I couldn't handle anybody touching me, but I didn't want to say anything. So I just learned to shove my emotions down because I didn't want anything else stirred up in the household. You know, it was hard. And so, yes, we moved to California. It seems like the logical thing to do. I mean, why would anybody want to stay in a place like that? So we moved to California, and my brother started he went from a very, you know, just really good student to then dressing differently, acting differently, started vandalizing things, started doing all sorts of stuff, causing a lot of commotion for my parents. So I became the child that I guess kind of had the expectations of being good and no problems and stuff like that. Right. And needless to say, I was kind of feeling, I guess, neglected or just invincible, because my brother was getting a lot of attention. So, I tried to start dressing crazy, like gothic or whatever. And just, I would never get the same kind of attention as my brother, no matter what. But, California is a different breed of people, in my opinion. I was in second or third grade when we moved there. And I'll tell you what, from Colorado,
California?
Yes, yes.
Were you that young, or were you, I think you were a little older, no?
So 89 is when he got convicted. I remember being third or fourth grade.
Fourth grade makes more sense.
Does it? Okay. Sorry, it's been a long time ago.
Yeah, that's okay.
So when we get to California, people are very different there. They are about status, they are about looks. And so I found out very quickly I didn't fit up to standards with I wasn't skinny enough, I wasn't pretty enough, I wasn't this enough. And those just added on to a lot more insecurities, which I still suffer with today because of that. I mean, I developed faster than most girls and then was picked on for that, that still stems with me today. All of these feelings of not good enough and all this shame and
right,
just not feeling anything, I guess. But
now that led to you doing something else when you were in sixth grade. What happened?
Thank you. So I remember coming home from school, and so already on top of everything that happened in my life, I'm carrying so much weight inside, so much emotion, so much emotions that I don't even understand at this point. And Adam, add a woman, a girl turning into a woman on top of that, because I developed very early, and I went into the bathroom and grabbed a shaving razor. I had watched a movie where somebody had cut their wrist or tried to kill themselves. So I cut my wrist up and instantly felt all of those feelings that were bottled up in me kind of dissolving for the moment because of the sting and burn, really, of the cutting. And, part of me felt a couple things. Part of me felt embarrassed, like my parents are gonna see this, they're gonna get mad at me. And part of me felt relieved. And so that cutting becomes an addiction too, because it's a quick relief of these emotions. Now, my parents, like any good parents would, because you got to understand, we all know about these kind of monsters in the world, right? And we might have kids and stuff, but just hope that we're not one of those families that gets hit with that. Right. So no parents are given manuals when they have children of what to have, what to do.
Yeah, how to deal with this, sure.
Yes, and so my parents did, well, they put my brother in therapy and then they put me in therapy. And back in the early 90s, it really more was, here's some medication for your trauma. Here's Prozac, here's pills. They knew there was trauma. They knew there was an event that happened. And it was kind of like, let's dish out pills. And so the doctors prescribed me. And like I said, I was, my gosh, I was like, 11, 12 getting, I want to say Prozac maybe was the first one. I'm not sure. And what did I end up doing on that? I tried to take an overdose of it. And my mother gave me, I think it's called Ikapac syrup. It'll make you induce vomit.
Right.
She's a nurse.
Okay. So she, at least she has that experience. She knows what to do. Thank God.
Yes. I couldn't tell you if I knew I was taking a lethal overdose. I just knew that I was, I mean, I don't even know what was going on in my brain, except I didn't like what I was feeling inside. And I was starting to see that my existence just, I didn't like it anymore. I felt horrible inside. I felt damaged. I felt invincible. I felt unpopular. I felt like I had no friends. I felt like I didn't belong in this world. I didn't fit in. I mean, so I didn't, I think I kind of knew what I was doing, but probably more for attention seeking at that point, mm-hmm. The fact of seeing my brother get all this more negative attention, but at least it was attention. Right.
Right.
So
then came the Gothic scene.
Yes. So, from California, we moved around a lot. Okay. So, my dad thought it was in his best interest, to take another job in Texas. And so we moved to Dallas, Texas. And, at this point, my brother had ran away, right? He ran away and was still in California. And finally, the police found him and brought him to Texas. It was just, my poor parents. So we started another school. And let me tell you, that's difficult too. That is difficult to keep starting schools in the middle of semester, or in school semesters or whatever. And get to know people or to say goodbye to friends that you made. And that becomes something in itself too.
Right.
And so, yeah. Now my brother was getting so much attention and had seemed to have so many friends because he was dressing, quote unquote, cool, like the skateboarders, the Gothics, or, wearing a chain and stuff and hanging with the bad crowd. But he was getting, in my opinion, everything that I wanted. Like, I felt like I couldn't make a friend. I had like one friend. I wanted popularity. I wanted to feel important. And so, yeah, I started trying to be like him, I guess. Mm-hmm. And, it just, like I said, for some reason, maybe it's just because I'm the girl and the baby girl, like the attention, my parents were like a lot rougher on me than my brother. I think that's because, like I said, I had the expectations to be the winning kid, I guess, which is why I'm probably a perfectionist, which is horrible. But
now, how old were you when you started smoking and when you started to dabble in drugs and alcohol?
So that was about 12, 13. This is right when we moved to Texas. So my brother smoked cigarettes. So I, thought he was cool. And that's really the only reason you ever start smoking cigarettes is because you think you're cool smoking cigarettes. Right. So 13, and my brother was the first person that gave me drugs, which was, I think, weed. It was weed back then. And then there was another drug they were doing. I think he had opium. I don't even know if that exists in this world anymore. Like opiates do, but like the opium, right? And, you know, I was following his footsteps, I guess. And so that was my first experience of altering my state of mind, I guess, with substance. And my body doesn't react well with weed. I get sick. So it's not appealing to me. Same thing with alcohol, but the only time I drank is when I wasn't legally supposed to. And that's probably because of the excitement of doing something like bad or something.
Right.
Because when I became 21, it was just like, this is no fun. I'm allowed to do it. But so yeah, there's till 13. Yeah. And then we move on. We ended up moving to another place in Texas, right? So, my God, starting a new school again. And it's because my brother was acting out. And so they thought if we move schools and then get a fresh start, you know, things will be okay. And this is why my whole life, I feel like I need to run away, I think.
So now, all right, your next phase is you move from not too terrible drugs to cocaine.
Yep.
All right. And you were what, about 15?
15. I was 15.
When you got addicted to coke.
I was. And I'll never forget it.
So what happened then?
So
did you go for treatment? Did you go
I did. So when I first got, so I was, you know, in that gothic scene, I did play in a band and was like a little punk rocker and stuff. So in my eyes, that was part of the scene. Drugs were a part of the rock and roll scene, right? Mm-hmm. But it's just crazy how there are things in your life you'll say you'll never do. Like, you know, I'll never do this. I'll never touch this drug. I'll never do that. And you end up doing these things. It's crazy because I've described before remembering the DARE officer come to our school in elementary school, right? With all that drug kits, all these videos, these horrible videos of the effects of drugs. And it terrified me. Like, why would anybody ever want to do this? It's horrible. So at 15, I was with a friend and she wanted me to meet some guy. Anyways, they had cocaine and this guy laid out my initials. He spelled my initials out in coke. And my first thing is like, no, I will never do that. Cause I remember all the bad things I was told about it. Right.
Right.
But the part inside of me that wanted to feel something else, right. Did it. And the first time I did it, I didn't feel whatever I was supposed to feel. I didn't feel the effects until the second time I did coke again. And that's when I felt the immediate feeling of what I will explain in that moment as in an adolescent way is what heaven on earth felt like, what no painful emotions. I felt strong. I felt socially accepted. I felt strong. I felt good inside. Mm-hmm. And that's why we get hooked on drugs and chase them for a long, long time.
Right.
And not to mention the fact that some of my friends' parents were like corporate executives doing coke, having cocaine parties. And you want to talk about enticing, how that looked in my eyes? Like, these people are wealthy and these people have fun. They had tons of people. They'd have Playboy mansion parties. I mean, so to me, I started developing in my head, that's the life that I want. Uh-huh. That looks like such a great life. This drug feels good. Money seems, and it must come with it, right? You know, the status of coke was like that rich people did it. And it just, it's a life that I started believing that I wanted. But within a month of doing the drug, I quickly started knowing that I was addicted to it. all the money, all the little money that I had saved up. I had like a few grand saved up. It was gone. It was gone in a month. And we were literally giving pennies to a dealer. I mean, and another sick fact that some people know about, some people don't, is that we've got a lot of drug dealers out there that are of, meaning 18 plus years old. They're selling drugs to minors. Not only that, trying to mess around sexually with minors. Now, being like a 15 and 16 year old girl, when an older guy is hitting on you, right? In your distorted mind, you think you're cool or something. And I don't know why. I don't know why, or maybe that was just me. I don't think I was the only female that felt that way. But really, that's what we call like a pedophile, you know?
Absolutely.
My addiction, coke will take you down pretty quickly. It'll take you to places you don't ever want to be at. And I eventually told my mom. I think she saw the signs. I was isolating. I lived up in my room. I mean, I was going through an eight ball a day, which is, I don't know how much it costs nowadays, but that was a lot of money, especially for somebody who's in school and working for $4.25 an hour, you know? And my mother, she put me into a kind of adolescent facility for addicts and mental health, I think too. We were able to do our schoolwork there and stuff. And I did good. I did good there for a second. But when I look back now, I remember finding like a guy that I clinged with, you know, and kind of was substituting that from the addiction. And I think a lot of addicts understand this. And that's why they say don't get into relationships. And we all know the tricks of the trade is we try to substitute one thing for another. And we usually try to substitute relationships that probably aren't the healthiest, thinking that we'll get away from the drug addiction because we really don't want to face ourselves.
Right.
It's just a Band-Aid. It's another Band-Aid.
Right. So now, did you ultimately graduate from high school?
I did. I ended up finishing out with just like the last 6 months with the homeschool. My mother had even put me in like a Christian school and I got kicked out for cocaine use. And she even put me, there was even like a little high school they had for kids that had substance abuse problems. And we got UA'd and stuff like that. And once again, I stayed sober for 9 months, but met a guy there who was a heroin addict. And I was labeled myself as just a coke addict, right? So in my sick world, I thought, he doesn't like my drug and I don't like his drug and we could have this happily family and be sober the rest of our lives. It's just the way my mind thought back then. And, you know, I stayed clean, but a lot of the times two addicts will relapse together. You know, I think at this point in my life, I just wanted some acceptance, some love that I was searching for. I thought that I could find that in other people. I thought that they would help my healing process. So I did graduate high school. I did go to college and, I would have these sober times, right? I'd stay sober and do what I need to do, you know, go to college. And then my addiction would resurface somehow. Usually because of a relationship. I went to a few different colleges, but, you know, I would stay sober, like I said, and then meet somebody, and everything in my life was so intense. Like every relationship I was in was so intense and kind of like an addiction in itself. And then something would go south or something. And I'd go back to my coping mechanism because by this time in my life, I've established that drugs help me cope with things I don't want to feel. right? But at this point, I'm chasing a high that I'll never get back. Those one-time feelings of the euphoria and stuff don't exist anymore, but you chase it for years, you know? So,
Lindsay, thank you so much for sharing your story, at least part one. We're out of time right now. So what we're going to do is we're going to pick this up within the next couple of days. And I really want to thank you for being so forthright with your story. I'm humbled by the courage that you have in order to do this. And it's so important for my audience that they should hear this and understand what it's all about in case they're in that position. But I think what you're doing is generous, in general, very, very heroic. And my hat is off to you, but we will get back to recording next time and we will continue on with the story. You've been listening to Whispers and Bricks, and I'm your host, Ari Shoman. Remember, if you feel like you're stuck in the mud, like you're spinning your wheels, wasting time in your career, your business, your life, if you know you're not enjoying all the success, satisfaction, and significance that you desire, then it's time for you to book a call with me at www.callwithari.com. Check out my Whispers and Bricks Coaching Academy. Until next time, listen to the whispers, avoid the bricks, and never, ever give up on your dreams. Bye for now.
So that's it for today's episode of Whispers and Bricks. Head on over to iTunes and subscribe to the show. One lucky listener every single week that posts a review on iTunes will win a chance in the grand prize drawing to win a $25,000 private VIP day with Ari himself. Be sure to head on over to whispersandbrickspodcast.com and pick up a free copy of Ari's gift and join us on the next episode.